Okay, so we're going to begin. Now, we're discussing the biography or the life of Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner. I know him as the Rosh Yeshiva. That's how we would know him, and that's how we would address him in the third person, the Rosh Yeshiva. Now, he was a very enigmatic person, a very mysterious person, and as much as you knew about him, you knew nothing about him. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky once said about him, to know Rav Huttner is only if you're Rav Huttner, you can know who you are. Nobody could know him. And we're going to do a little bit about his biography. Let me just start out by saying that it is, for me personally, very, very difficult to even speak about Rav Huttner because of the meaning that he has for me and my family and anybody who actually knew him very, very well and the influence, the impact that he had. So that even to speak about him is something tremendously irreverent, something that is very difficult. But nonetheless, to speak a little bit about him, some biographical material. As it happens, we know almost nothing about him biographically. We don't know anything about his parents. We know that he had siblings. We don't know their name. He never spoke about them. Almost never saw them. And he was a very concealed person. In Yiddish, he would say, "Ich bin a behaltener Mensch." He would often say that about himself, that he was difficult to know. He was born in 1906 in Warsaw. His parents were Gera Hasidim. So if one would want to understand why in his later life he used the Hasidic garb of Gera Hasidim is because he was born into that kind of a family. Now, he was an individual who was very unique in that he was Eastern European through and through, and he studied throughout the system of Eastern Europe. But on the other hand, he was a person who was very much of the Western world. And somehow, all of these things found resolution within him. He was a Talmudist of a very, very high level. He was a poet, very poetic. He was a musician. He wrote music. He appreciated music. He could, by heart, do all of the Italian operas. Not something that he would often tell people in public. I remember him humming, "I really just do." If you ever were in his apartment and you were speaking to him and getting him a tea, I'll get to that a little bit later, and you would hear him singing Italian opera. It was something which he knew. He knew all classical music. He loved Bach. He loved the contrapuntal sounds, maybe because of the contradictions within them that are somehow resolved with beautiful music. And he was also a pietist. He was a very religious person, very, very devout, very devout. He was a very private person. Even though he had a public persona, he was very private and he was very shy human being. Now, also, even though he was purely yeshivish, purely Eastern European, he was a lover of Zion, a tremendous lover of Zion. But at the very same time, he was anti-Zionist. And he was a person who was very liberal. I personally felt much of my personal interaction with him. Also, he was very liberal with me. So I felt that openness that he had, but on the other hand, he was very, very conservative. He was a person who advocated the practices of the Gra of the Vilna Gaon, which are misnagdim, but at the very same time, he was a practicing chassid. All of these are contradictions that are somehow resolved. And one of the letters that he wrote, he quotes a medrash. The medrash says that when God created Adam, when God created Adam, he took from Afros Tevel, he took from all of the earth, from all over the earth, he took parts of that earth to create Adam. Rashi says so that he could be buried in any place on earth. So Rav Huttner said, "I am like Adam Harishon, that I am from Dalet Kitzvo Sa'aretz. I was gathered from Poland, from Lithuania, from Riga, from Germany, from Eretz Yisrael, and from the USA, and that's who I am. I'm a composite of all of those sources." We know that when he was very young, which was typical of, well, I don't want to get involved because I have limited time, so I don't want to go into any excrescences, but trust me when I say that the typical great yeshiva boy was already a great yeshiva boy by the time he was 13 and 14. And all of the people, they went to this yeshiva, they went to Valozhin, they went to Slabotka, they went to Tells. That means they went there when they were 13 and 14. the entrance exams to these schools were basically you had to know all of Noshim and Ezekiel with Rashi and Tosfos by heart. If you're a Daf Yomi person, you can just imagine what that is. And by the age of 13, 14, many of these young men had mastered all of those disciplines. When he was 14, he went to the Lomza Yeshiva, and he stayed there a brief period of time. He felt that he had learned whatever he could. Then he went back to Varsha, he went back to Warsaw, and from there he saw that he was not going to grow in the manner that he wanted to. So he, on his own, all of this on his own. Today, parents, they buy tickets for you, and they give you credit cards, and they give you two cell phones. He was alone. All these boys were alone. And from the time he was 14 until he was 26, he never saw his parents. Never went back home. And he went to Slabodka, which, as we're going to see, was a major, major influence on his life. From Slabodka, he went to the Slabodka in Hebron, because part of the yeshiva had already moved to Israel, so he was in Hebron. Interestingly enough, on the Shabbos of the massacre, in 1929, he went to Rav Kook's house for Shabbos in Jerusalem. If not, he would have been killed. So he once said, it was on Purim, so I don't know exactly, although on Purim, I sat next to him once on Purim, and he had a bottle that he kept on drinking from. It turned out that it was water with vanilla coloring. So, and he made believe, because he didn't... If you knew him, you knew he's not the kind of person that's going to drink and get drunk. But anyway, but he once said that Rav Kook saved his life because he invited him for that Shabbos. Okay, going back. So he was there, and from Hebron he went back to Warsaw, and from Warsaw he went to the University of Berlin, and from the University of Berlin he went back to Warsaw. He got married. He went to Hebron for a year, and he went back to Kovna. And then he came to America. And then eventually he went to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so that's a little bit of his odyssey, a tremendous odyssey. Now, why did he go to all of those places? Now, first of all, it's important to know that many young men who were prodigies would go from yeshiva to yeshiva. They would imbibe the waters of the uniqueness of each of the Russia yeshiva, who were all different, who were all great, but with differences, but all unique. All individuals, and they would drink from the waters of their Torah until they were satisfied, and they would go on, because these people who were looking for everything they possibly could in terms of Torah and in terms of piety. In a number of the letters that he wrote, he indicated that it was in the years that he was in Slabodka, from 1921 to 1927, that was the period that developed him and created the person. What am I supposed to do? I don't touch it.
Continue.
Oh, no problem. And he indicated that this was the period that developed him as the person that he was. Now, saying just a drop about Slabodka. Now, in Slabodka, there was a Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Epstein, Moshe Epstein, who was, by all indications, a giant in Torah. But there was another person who was perhaps much more influential, even though he wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva, and it was Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, the Ranatz Finkel, the Altar of Slabodka. It was known as the Altar of Slabodka. And he made the greatest impression on Rav Huna. And he would always say that what did he learn from the Mashgiach? What did he learn from the Altar of Slabodka? He learned two things. He learned intellectual piety, how one can be pious without wearing their religion on their sleeve. And he also learned intellectual independence, that a person has to be independent because each person is unique. Lama nivraha adam yechidi, shela olam yomar adam bishvili nivraha olam, which means that every human being is so unique, there is nobody else like themselves, and therefore each person has to develop who he or she is. You can't copy anybody else. You can't say, I want to be just like Michael Jordan. No, you have to be your own person. Now, to say something about Ranatz Finkel, who himself was very mysterious and very enigmatic. Let me just say this. I have, in my lifetime, known a number of very great people. And with very rare exception, they're all mysterious. And they're all enigmatic. And they're all difficult to really understand. There's a lot of self-concealment that great people have. So it's very hard to know them. But Ranatz Finkel developed a kind of mussar, without getting into the history of the Tnuat HaMusav, the Muslim movement, which began a generation before that with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and it broke off into a number of schools. The dominant school was the Rav Simcha Zissel school. That was a dominant school because he was one of the major disciples of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. But Rabbi Finkel, the Alter of Slabodka, developed his own form of the Salanterian Musa, which was known, it was known as Gadlut HaAdam, the greatness of the human being. In other words, the level of Musar, which means the development of character and personality on a Torah way. And the way that you develop that character and that personality is by demonstrating the greatness that you can rise to, that you're not just a regular person. I'm just blood, flesh and blood. You're more than that. Because you're endowed with intelligence, you're endowed with a soul, you can become great. But you have to become great in terms of who you are. And that was the methodology of the Alter of Slabodka, and that is something that Rav Huttner, as a young person, he very much gravitated towards. Now, Renatz Finkel lived in the yeshiva. He rarely went home. They say that he went home maybe once a year, when he had a wife and children. Maybe once a year, and usually not for a few years would he go home. But he literally lived in the yeshiva. And in that way, he could see the development or lack of development of the boys. And also keep in mind, which I didn't mention, any yeshiva was the elite because everybody else worked. You don't have like you have today. Everybody goes to yeshiva, and then they send them to Israel for a year, and they do Shana Bet. And then you go, okay, do Shana Gimel, please, please, please. And then you, right? And then you'll, it didn't exist. It didn't exist. The best in every town went to the next town. There was a further winnowing away, and only from every great city, there was one person or two people that emerged, and they went to the yeshivas. So that you really had the creme de la creme, you had the elite. That's what a yeshiva boy was. There's no fooling around. So that Rabbi Finkel was able to know the progress of all of the young men in the school, and they also were able to watch him. They were able also to observe him, how he prayed and how he studied and how he behaved, how he interacted with other human beings. And Rav Huttner said, it's in one of his letters, that he learned two important lessons that would be lessons for his life from Renatz Finkel. The first was the art of self-concealment, which is, well, I'll get to it in a second. And also how to be a proper pedagogue, to be a proper teacher. Let's see what those two elements are. Self-concealment means, even though you have intellectually accomplished much, and even if you are now intellectually superior to others, you could know that, you should know that. But your humility demands that you keep it to yourself. And that's not easy. When you're great, to keep your greatness to yourself is an art. It takes a tremendous discipline. Most people who are great tell you that they're great. They can't keep it in. I'm smarter than you. I'm better than you. And these people were smarter and better, but self-concealment. And the other is pedagogy, how to teach. And this is something that was the hallmark, not only of Rav Huttner, but all of his students who became teachers, which was not to implant your own perspective in the students. That's not what proper pedagogy is. But what you need to do is you refine the qualities and the capacities of the student. You teach the student how to reach within to create the best person they can become based upon their unique talents and their abilities. So that when you teach, which is often a mistake, he would say, that teachers make is not to share the burden of your own spiritual failures and cast them on the child. That's time sometimes you would have teachers who would like get angry and they would hit and they would scream and they call you idiot, shaita. If you ever went to real yeshiva, this would not be something that would be unusual. And he said, you may not do that because that's, you're sharing the burden of your own spiritual failure. That's why you're yelling and screaming. And that's why you're so frustrated. You're frustrated. Don't take it out on the child. And also not to share the glory of your attainment with the students and say, be like me. You've got to be like me. That is not proper pedagogy. And that he learned from Renatz Finkel. But what you need to do is you need to nurture, you need to illuminate the personality and the characteristics of the budding disciples of the students. Now, in Slabodka, greatness in Torah was taken for granted. The fact that you would sit through three storim and stay up most nights and learn with great diligence without any distractions, that was taken for granted. That's why are you in yeshiva? Otherwise, get a job. But the different level of students was based upon character, piety. Because these were yeshivas that were based upon Musa. They were based upon, even though they were the Beit Midrashot Shel Hagra, all of the yeshivas were in the Nusach of the Gra, of the Vilna Gaon. If you trace it, the disciple of Vilna Gaon's Reb Chaim of Valojin and Reb Chaim Chalojin students, they opened up all the other yeshivas. So all of this is based Midrashot Shel Hagra, the Vilna Gaon. But on the other hand, they were also yeshivas that were predicated on the Musar movement of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Okay, we know that there were great debates and great fights in the yeshiva, how much of it, how little of it, whatever. But that was the mission statement of these yeshivas. And that was the idea of character building and piety building was the essence of the experience that he had in Slabodka. Now, what was the method? Now, here the Alter of Slabodka, Ranatz Finkel, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, was very unique, as all of the Baalei Musa were unique in their own approach. His approach, I mentioned before, is Gadlut HaAdam, to bring out the greatness in every individual. For every individual to know they're capable of being great, of being superior. But his unique ability was taking philosophy, Jewish philosophy, medieval Jewish philosophy, combining it with the Talmudic, Agadic lessons, and together with that, bringing out and sometimes even reading into them a lesson of ethics, of morality, of a higher level of behavior that is demanded of an individual. And this is what this was the foundation for the greatness that Rav Huttner would later achieve. In 1925, he left the Slabodka. As I mentioned, he went to Israel. Now, he went in 1925, if you remember, Rav Kook was the chief rabbi, and in 1925, he really was at the top of his career. He lived in Yerushalayim, he began in Yafo, Tel Aviv, and then he took ill, he died in 1935. But in 1925, he was at the height of his power, the height of his creativity. And that is exactly when Rav Huttner came to Israel in 1925. Now, to say something about Rav Kook, because really, as I understand it, Rav Huttner is a reflection of Rav Kook in many ways. But Rav Kook was unique. I don't know, we don't know much about Rav Kook. We should. He's not studied. For some reason, he's not studied. Unless you go to Merkaz Harav, he's not studied. But Rav Kook was the greatest of the great. As a matter of fact, Rav Huttner once commented, because as you know, he was very Rav Kook was embroiled in many controversies. He was a delicate, sweet human being, but he was embroiled in many controversies because of his unique philosophy in life. And they once asked Rav Huttner about this. He was hesitant to speak about Rav Kook, but they once asked him about that. Hey, it's terrible. He went against all these people. They mentioned the names of the great people that Rav Kook fought. So Rav Huttner said, I promise you that Rav Kook was 10 times greater than all of those rabbis combined. Maybe he shouldn't have argued with them, but in terms of his ability, he was 10 times greater than all of them. So that he certainly appreciated Rav Kook. But let's talk about Rav Kook. Now, what made Rav Kook different than everybody else? His Torah greatness, we know how he got to Israel. The way he got to Israel was... Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do it full. And if you have to leave, just leave. Because the last time I sort of like killed my lecture because people were telling me that you have like a certain amount of time. So I'm going to take not too much time, but I want to develop it. Rav Kook came to Israel because Yafo, Tel Aviv didn't exist yet. Yafo had a tremendous problem. It was a Sephardic community and a burgeoning Ashkenazic community. And they were at war with each other. And the Ashkenazic rabbi died. And it made the Ashkenazi inhabitants of Yafo more wild. And the Sephardic rabbi quit because he couldn't deal with all the controversies in the city. It's a small city. So the Zion Tuvei Ho'ir sent a telegram to Israel, to Europe, to Kletsk. And they said, can you send us the best student that you have who's wise and who knows how to learn the best? So they sent Rav Kook. Rav Kook was known as the best in learning in Kletsk, which was a big yeshiva. That's how we got there. And of course, he brought peace between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim, and he became everybody's rabbi. He became the Ashkenazi rabbi, and he became the Sephardi rabbi, and he did very, very well there. And that is how he got to be the chief rabbi in Yerushalayim, because he was a person who was able to bring everybody together. That's how he got there. So he was a person who was known for his greatness in learning. But he also was able to bring together many opposites. He was from a tradition of Hitnagdut. He was a Mitnaged. He was part of the yeshiva movement of Europe, of Eastern Europe. He was Eastern European. And they did not in any way countenance the Hasidic movement. But on the other hand, he was a person, we know that on Pesach night, on the night of Pesach, he would daven in Chabad because he wanted to say Hallel. And the minhag on the yeshivas was not to say Hallel. So that he had an affinity for Hasidus. He also was a person who was a tremendous poet. If you read his writings, if you can read his writings, you see it's exquisite poetry. And the imagery is really beautiful. He was a musician. He played the violin. He composed a number of violin pieces. He was also a mystic of a very high level. And he was also very pietistic. He was an exceedingly, exceedingly religious man, exceedingly religious person. Now, he did something which was unique, which was, he was able to, as you know, at that time, most of the Zionists who lived in Israel were communist and socialist. And as communists and socialists, they were atheists. And as atheists, they were anti-religion. But they were Zionists. They wanted to build the land of Israel because there was prejudice and anti-Semitism all over Europe. But on the other hand, they could not countenance religious people who they believed were fossilized and just kept the Jewish people back from progressing. Rav Kook was able to develop a philosophy where the people who were anti-religious, they were part of a worldview. They were part of a movement where the entire world was coming back to God. And in their building the land of Israel, they facilitated this move, this return. He called those the nitzotzei teshuvah. Now, teshuvah for him doesn't mean chotasi visi pashati. It means the entire universe is reversing back and coming back to God, and things are changing, and the Mashiach, the Messianic era, is about to come. And he was able to do that, and he created a mystical worldview that incorporated all Jews, not only all Jews but even non-Jews. And what he was able to do, interesting, there's a letter that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Zatzal had, and it's found in the writings of Rivka Schatz Uffenheim, who was the head of the philosophy department in Hebrew University, and she published this letter where Rav Kook, and heretofore was unpublished, where he said the greatest mistake that the rabbis made in the 17th century was in censuring and banning Spinoza. He said, had they embraced Spinoza as they embraced the Baal Shem Tov, he said, there's little difference between them, he said, philosophically, because Spinoza believed in pantheism, and the Baal Shem Tov believed in panentheism. So he said there was very little difference. And yet they found a way. Right? If you know early Hasidus, you know that they were considered to be heretics. But yet they found a way to embrace them and to incorporate them. He said, had they had patience with Spinoza, who was a great thinker and a great Jew, the world would be different, and that all of the Jews would be together and there would be no forces that are antagonistic to one another. So it was a great mistake that they made. So that he did have a very strong foothold in the secular world. He knew science, he knew math, he knew astronomy, he knew physics, all autodidactic, all self-taught. And therefore, he incorporated all of these things into a harmony, into a perfection that he called the Torah, that he called Judaism. That was what was unique about everything else is just detail, but that was the uniqueness of Rav Kook. And in that, Rav Hutner, who was himself a combination of disparate parts, sometimes opposites, he found a resonance. He found a chord, C-H-O-R-D, that he was able, that resonated very, very much with him. And therefore, he went to study with Rav Kook. Now, when we say study with Rav Kook, unlike Ranatz Finkel, the Alto Sabbat, who was concealed, who was private, who was mysterious, who never wrote anything. All of the writings that we have of Ranatz Finkel, we have from his students who wrote the lectures that they heard. But Rav Kook was just the opposite. He was effusive, he was open, he wrote. As a matter of fact, we know that Rav Kook used to write with a pencil because it was a rush of consciousness that when he would write, if you didn't write with a pencil, you used a pen, you'd have to interrupt the writing to dip the ink, the quill into the inkwell. Right? We're talking about the 1920s. And he could not delay because he'd lose the thought. So he wrote, he was spontaneous in terms of his writing, spontaneous in terms of his thought. And he lectured extensively. So he was very, very open. Everything that he thought spilled out of him, either in the spoken word or in the written word. And that was something that was different than the Alta of Slabodka, but it complemented the Alta of Slabodka. So that in the Alta of Slabodka, he found the ultimate pietist in which he could come close to God. But in Rav Kook, he saw the ultimate intellectual in which he'd be able to perfect his intellect, which was great. And that is how Rav Hutner, who wanted both, that is how he came to Rav Kook. And he wrote, he never quoted Rav Kook, but you see this in his, which is later on, he wrote a book, I'll talk about it in a second, I just want to buttress what I'm about to say. He wrote a sefer, a little bit later than this, called Toras HaNazir, on Maseches Nazir. And in the original, I looked for it this morning, I actually have a copy of it, I put it in a place that I would never lose it, but it would be safe. And it's there. So, it's safe. But I couldn't bring it. I couldn't locate it. Which was the original Toras HaNazir. Other editions, the second, third, other editions will not have this. But in the first edition, the Haskama, the letter of approbation, is from Rav Kook. And in it, Rav Kook wrote that Rav Hutner learned the art of fearlessness in intellectual search, and that Rav Hutner is loyal to his vision and aspirations and self-revelation. And says, and in Lomdus, it's in the Sefer. So that is what he learned from Rav Kook, which is really one of the most important aspects of Rav Hutner, was a fearlessness. Absolute, because in the Jewish world, there is censure, especially in the higher echelons, in terms of what you think and what you say. And he was fearless in that regard, totally fearless in that regard. And he always, for him, his intellectual purity was very, very important. Okay, getting back to Rav Hutner. In 1929, that was 25, so he was there for 4 years. In 1929, he comes back to Warsaw, and he's 23 years old. All of this is taking place. He's just today we would consider a kid. But he was not. He was born mature. In those days, you were born mature. If you were one of these people, you didn't go through all of the phases that we go through, all the silliness that we go through today. You were very, very mature. So in 1929, he went back to Warsaw, and he stayed home for only a few weeks. And he said, he later would say, I have to be mekayem the mitzvah of kibbutz ov ha'em. And I haven't seen my parents in many, many years. And he stayed there. And I guess in a few weeks, his parents said, okay, it's time for you to go back to yeshiva. Right? His parents obviously were very, very happy with his quest. But rather than going back to yeshiva, since he was on this odyssey, he goes to Berlin. And in Berlin, he wanted to study in the university. Now, at the very same time, it's like a zeitgeist, there were a number of other young Jewish prodigies who also happened to have been in Berlin at the same time. One of them was Harry Austin Wolfson, who was one of the Elter Bachrim in Slabodka, somebody that Rav Hutner looked up to as a very, very great mind. And he was in Berlin. Yeah, he got his doctorate in philology. Then he went to Harvard University, where he was It was Dr. Hyman's Rebbe, if you know anything about Arthur Hyman, from Yeshiva University and from Columbia. And he also met, at that time, He also met Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was also in the University of Berlin. Now, he was already a little bit older than Rav Futner, and he also met Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who was also there at the same time. Now, all of them were on their own odysseys, and he also met Rabbi Avraham Yoshua Heschel, who was also sent by his mother. Right? He's a chassid, he was a chassidisha from a chassidisha. Right, the Heschels were the Abdurov. This is like a very dynasty, a Hasidic dynasty. So you have the Soloveitchiks were a dynasty. They were there. And you have many other people who were there. The first person that he met when he got to Berlin was somebody who he knew from Slabodka, but was almost on his way out of Slabodka when Rav Futner went in. And that was Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg, the Sridei Eish. Now, the Sridei Eish was a Talmud of Slabodka, obviously a super genius. And Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg came to, he was almost twice Rav Futner's age at this time. He was 40. He was 44, Rav Futner was 23. And he had gotten his doctorate. He had already gotten his doctorate. And his doctorate was in critical analysis of texts. That's what Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg got his doctorate in. That was part of the Wissenschaftler Judentum movement, the Chachmat Yisrael movement, of how to analyze various texts and write critical editions. So, he met with Sridei Eish, and he was very impressed with this level of critical scholarship. It appealed to him, to his mind, a very analytic mind. And what he did was, he decided to find a text that he can apply this new discipline to. And he found a text. It was the commentary of a great Italian rabbi of the 1400s, Rabbi Hillel of Verona, Italy, who wrote a commentary on the Sephra. Now, the problem was there were a number of manuscripts. It was written in Italian script, which was a much different kind of a script for manuscripts than you had in the other medieval scripts of Spain and of France and Germany. So Rav Futner immediately taught himself to read Italian. And then from there, he was able to learn the Italian script. We're talking about in weeks. Now, I actually worked with Aryeh Kaplan. I was a proofreader for the Torah anthology. And I was there when he learned Ladino. He learned Ladino in a matter of weeks. He didn't speak a word of Spanish. And he learned Ladino. So I know that it could be done. If you're like a super genius, you can learn a new language very, very easily. And for us, it sounds like, you know, mamma mia, you're going to learn Italian in like a few weeks. But for great geniuses, especially if you have a facility for language, and if you ever read any of Rav Hutner's works, you see that his ability to communicate in words is incomparable. And that's what he proceeded to do. So in very short order, in 1 year, he wrote, he read, analyzed various manuscripts, and he published the Safra with the commentary of Rav Hillel of Verona, which you can buy in any good bookstore. And he did that because he wanted, as a result of the meetings of Rabbi Weinberg, he wanted to incorporate that discipline into his Torah scholarship. Now, in the university, we know that he studied philosophy, he studied physics, he studied math, he was a great mathematician, he knew physics, but his expertise was in the area of the mind, and therefore he's better known for the philosophy that he studied there. So that Rav Futner never allowed his breadth of knowledge, B-R-E-A-D-T-H, breadth of knowledge, to be limited. He wanted to know everything, which is truly what a great mind wants, not to be limited, to know everything they possibly can. And his purpose was to be a better Oved Hashem, to be a better Jew, and to be a better teacher. Because the more you know, the better that you can do with that knowledge, as long as you keep it in the proper perspective. And in that way, Rav Futner was much different than Rabbi Soloveitchik, if I may say. But I'm sure I'm not going to be asked to talk about Rabbi Soloveitchik because you probably think I can't. By the way, I can. Where Rabbi Soloveitchik made a very clear dichotomy and said, this is Torah, this is secular knowledge, and I believe that secular knowledge in and of itself is a worthy endeavor. It's not a handmaiden to the Torah. It is a worthy endeavor in and of itself. And Rav Futner would not do that. And he would say that all secular knowledge is part of the Torah. because God was the greatest biologist, and the Torah is the and God is the greatest chemist and the greatest physicist, because He created the universe. And one of His great ideas was there is no stira, there's no contradiction between the quote unquote the secular world and the world of the holy, because it's one world, it's one integrated world, and they're all part of the same. They're all part of the same, and therefore anything that you study is part of the Torah. No reason for it to be separated from the Torah. And that was his point of view. I remember in the 70s when there were all these what agitates one age doesn't agitate the other. But I remember in the 60s and the 70s what agitated Orthodox Jews was the contradiction between science and the Torah. Books were written about it. And I remember they once asked him, like, you know all that stuff. What? So he said it in Yiddish, but he said it's a dover pashut. Either we don't know the Torah correctly, or we don't know the science correctly. But there can't be a stira. There can't be a contradiction. It's all one and the same. That was his approach. He didn't tell us any more than that. It would be great if he could do that, where we were erred in the Torah or in the science, but he didn't do that. But that was part of his Weltanschauung. That was part of how he saw the world. Now, for the rest of his life, Rav Hutnik kept these parts of his knowledge hidden. He would never lecture about Chachmat Yisrael, this is after Yutum, publicly. He would never lecture, he would not, even though we know, if you knew philosophy, you know that he loved Heidegger and Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, and he knew them very, very well. He would never quote them. If you look in his, I'll get to his Maimarim a little bit later, if you look at his Maimarim and you know those philosophies, you'll see them open, as bright as can be. But usually the people that he spoke to had no knowledge of those sources. So he was able to conceal it within the rubric of his discussion. Now, he left Berlin, and when he left Berlin, he went back to Warsaw. He went back home, and there he worked on his Torah. I mentioned this before, his Torah Sanazir, and that was to seal his credentials as an Eastern European scholar, because he had already decided what he wanted to do. And after he published the Torah Sanazir, and to wide acclaim, at that point, Rav Kook was not controversial, and that helped that he got that beautiful, beautiful approbation from Rav Kook. After he published that, the marriage proposals came raining down on him. Everybody now wanted him for a son-in-law, because he wrote the Torah Sanazir. Wow. Gevaldige Ilui. He was known as the Varsha of the Ilui. And he married a girl who was born in America, from a very, very wealthy family, and that would allow him, because you have to support a wife. I remember him saying that a few times. You have to support a wife. I know, now you couldn't say that anymore. Even in our circles, right? We pay for everything. Whatever. Another topic. And he moved to America. He went to Israel first for a year, but then he went to America. Now, within 1 year, he mastered the English language. I guess it takes longer to master that, because it's not a Romance language, it's English. We take it for granted that it's easy, but it seems that it's a harder language to master than European languages, than Romance languages. And it's also important to remember what yeshiva people looked like in those days. Now, I actually have a picture. It's in my Torah Sanazir, so I couldn't bring that either. Of what he looked like when he came to America. A Slabotka Talmud. They were dressed, Ranatz Finkel said, you have to dress conservatively elegant. And Rav Hutnik would dress white suit, beautiful blue shirt, white tie, and a white hat. That is how they dressed. Nobody dressed in black unless you were the Rosh Yeshiva. Nobody had a beard unless you were the Rosh Yeshiva. Everybody was clean shaven. Everybody was dressed well. One of the things that Ranatz Finkel taught my grandfather, who taught it to my father, who taught it to me, was, I don't know, always keep it, you have to make sure your shoes always have a buff shine. You have to. If you're a Talmud Chacham, you have to walk in the street, people have to see clean shoes. That was one of the, so that's how they dressed. They dressed elegantly, they dressed beautifully. Nobody had a beard. As a matter of fact, I know that a case, there's a story in the Pe'er Hador, the biography of the Chazon Ish, that in Kletsk, somebody felt the need to put on a beard. And the Rosh Yeshiva came over to him and said, if you want to be in my yeshiva, take a shave. You can't, I'm the Rosh Yeshiva, I have the beard. Can't have, you know, it meant something, right? It used to mean something. It meant it was something of distinction. So he arrived to America that way, and he found American culture very pleasing. He found the values and the ideals of the American to be very much in consonance with what he learned in Slobodka. Hard work, decency, morality, and ethics. That's the America that he came to in the 30s, which is what America was. It was a WASP philosophy that governed the country. He found it very, very pleasing. And he learned American customs and American ways of thinking, which made him different from the other people who came to open a yeshiva, because they were Rush yeshivas who were transplanted. And they were dressed in the traditional Rush yeshiva garb, and they spoke Yiddish, and they know nothing about America. They could barely pronounce it, America. That's how they would say it. And they really were really Eastern European, happening to live in America. But Rav Hutner was not that way. He was a person who adapted to the culture very, very easily, and he knew how to speak to the American street urchins that were living in Brownsville at the time. And he got a job in Chaim Berlin, which was in Brownsville, Brooklyn. And that was the beginning. And when he did that, not only did he adjust to America instantly, but they adjusted to him as a Rebbe immediately because he could talk their language. And that was something that made him very, very successful. And his plan was, this I remember him saying, that his plan was, so he started teaching in high school, and he had the senior class, because nobody can control the seniors. And he had the senior class, and he actually found success in teaching them. And what he said was, now I see what I can do, what I want to do. I want to transplant Eastern European Torah to America. I think it could be done. I think that it could be done. Many people thought it could not be done, including Rabbi Soloveitchik, that you could not transplant the Torah of Europe to America. Impossibility. And Rav Hutner believed that it could be done. It could be done. And he began to do that. But he had a game plan. Now, you know, as Americans, we're independent and autonomous and free. And that is how we grow up. And in other words, in plain Hebrew, anachnu lo mekablim shum marut mishum adam. We don't. So he decided that if he was going to be successful, he would have to adopt an authoritarian approach. Total authority, total strictness. And that I can promise you he did to the nth degree. To the nth degree. He introduced things that were unheard of. If you would address him, you'd have to address him in the third person. If you would say you, apachimpon. Moreover, you'd have to, if you were in his office, you'd have to walk out backwards. I'll tell you a personal story. Personal story. I live with this almost every day. I was 10, maybe 11 years old. I went to something called the Yeshiva of Eastern Parkway, which was a school that was a subordinate of Chaim Berlin. All of the rebbes were Chaim Berlin students of the Rosh Yeshiva. So I was in Rabbi Prager's class. Rabbi, oh, Chaim, you were with us. You know this. I was in Rabbi Prager's class, and the Rosh Yeshiva was coming to visit to give a faher to the best bachur, the best bachur. So the rebbes would choose one or two boys from each class to tell over a little shtickle Torah to Rav Hutner. So I was chosen. So I was nervous as can be, and my father drilled it into me and said, "Make sure you know it." I remember what it was. It was in Baba Kama, the first paragraph of Baba Kama. It was about Kerem and Olan. The Gemara Kerem and Olan. There's a Netziv, Kerem and Olan. Why is it Hechik Sivi and Olan? A ganze Geschichte. And I was like very nervous about it. And the whole school came there. The whole school was there. And he sat in the front like a potentate, which he was. He was considered like he came. Everybody was like shaking, quivering in their boots, including the rebbes. You know, and it was my turn. So I go over and I start saying the thing, you know, it was in Yiddish, stating the Gemara Azoy, and it's effect, blah, 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 blah. Very good. And I finished it, and I got through the whole thing. I was so relieved, I turned around and I walked out. And now you hear, Ingle!
Yingle,
which means punk. I turn around and it's him.
Kumta her. Was bin ich affaired?
So I had no clue. So I just burst out into tears. I just burst into tears. He says, "Oh, weit nicht. Gay. That was it. The Rebbe afterwards said, "Didn't I tell you that when you finish, you walk like this, and then you turn around?" And he did. But I had forgotten it. About 10 years later, I was in his office. So I came in. So he says, "Tut mal teuer fink, weint nicht." Okay. But that was my first. It's a powerful lesson. The idea was to teach Kavod HaTorah, something that we don't have. Kavod HaTorah, honor for Torah, through the personality of the Torah that teaches you the Torah. That is what he wanted to teach. And he was eminently successful. There were thousands of people whose Kavod HaTorah is sacrosanct because of the lessons that he taught. Tremendous, tremendous lesson. We can use a little bit more of that. Part of our undoing is that we have none of it. But that was what he knew had to be the strategy for this new world. Now, once he was successful being a Rebbe, it was a foray in Torah Vadas for a while, but once he was successful, he decided that he was going to take the Chaim Berlin and, with permission from the Menahem, expand it. Because heretofore, it was just a elementary school and a high school, and now he wanted it to be a Beis Medrash, and as the boys would marry, if they were worthy, to continue their learning and create a kola, which was unusual. There was no such thing in America. Now you have a kola everywhere. Everywhere's a kola. But this is not the same as this kind of kola, I promise you. And he called the kola Gur Aryeh, because at this point he also had another decision. Rather than using the Musar type of Ranatz Finkel or anybody else, which is a particular kind of a literature, as a matter of fact, he abandoned the Musar Seder. First he cut it from a half hour to 15 minutes, and then he said, "You better have learned Mishnah Berurah, at least you get something out of it." But he used the Maharal Prague as his mentor in order to communicate Torah to the American population. And because the Maharal, if you know Maharal, it also embodies many different strands. The Maharal knew secular philosophy of his time, the evil philosophy, and Torah, and rabbinic literature, and he read philosophy into rabbinic literature in a very unique style. A seamless kind of an interwoven tapestry that the Maharal was able to do. If you ever learn Maharal, you'll see it. And you'll be able to really extract different modes of thought from this from this writing. And he felt an affinity to the Maharal, and that is what he used. Once he had a kolel and a Beis Medrash, by 1941, that's when he grew a beard. That's when he got rid of his blue shirts and his white ties and his white hat, and he put on the traditional garb of a Rosh Yeshiva. Now he was a Rosh Yeshiva. Now he's allowed to. And he eventually, later on in his life, he went back. He adopted the garb of Hasidim, of Gerva Hasidim, and he wore Spadik, and he wore Bekesha, Gartel, etc., etc. On Shabbos and Yom Tov. But all of this is part of the bringing together opposites. The yeshiva adhered only to the Minhagei Agra, Misnage, and yet there was a tremendous feel of Hasidism in the school. And that was unique. Because he believed that you needed to have chassidus, because he believed that was a way of battling assimilation. Because that was one of the characteristics of chassidim. By their unique approach, they don't have much assimilation. Because who wants to assimilate with somebody who dresses like that, who looks like that? And therefore, he adopted both of them so that the Jews, which was happening at that time in the 40s, would not lose their Jewish identity. Now, let me just say something about his philosophy. Right, it's 9:57. I'm just going to take another 5 minutes. so that it'll be altogether an hour lecture, which is not too long. Now, he had respect for every rabbi, but he did not believe that any rabbi had a better opinion than he, except for one rabbi. And that was Rav Aaron. That was the only, not Shechter, but Rav Aaron Cutler. The only person who would defer to was Rav Aaron Cutler. Famous story. In 1942, he hooked up with Rabbi Mendelowitz of Torah Vadas, and they said, what we should really do is, let us have our boys learning all day, and let's get a college for them at the night. And that way, not everybody's going to learn all their lives. This way, they'll learn a profession. And we'll get accreditation, and we'll have a college. And the plans were well underway. Rav Aaron Cutler heard about that. He asked Rav Huttner to meet with him. We don't know what happened in the meeting, but we know that the plan was abandoned because he did not want that. He did not want that, and that was the only person that would demand his attention. He used to always, when he said Rav Aaron, he would never say Rav Aaron. He would always say Arisha B'Chabura, the lion of the Chabura. That's the esteem he held. Now, his magnum opus is not Torah Sanazir, nor is it the commentary of Hillel Verona on Safra, but it is his 8 volumes of Pachad Yitzchak. Now, I'm going to say just a word about Pachad Yitzchak. If you've never learned Pachad Yitzchak, now I actually had an original kuntres from 1954. It's together with the picture in the white hat in the Torah Sanazir, which I wanted to bring, which was a very interesting thing. Now, when these things were anonymous, they were published anonymously without attribution. And in it, and it was handwritten by his daughter, a great scholar on her own, and it was on the bottom of each page was Pnimi no'ad le'elu she'shamu'u balpeh. To really know what this means, you had to have been there. You had to have been there. Now, what does that mean? So I once asked Rabbi Aaron, his student, Rabbi Aaron Shechter, what does that mean? Pnimi no'ad le'elu she'shamu'u balpeh. So you were at a mimer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, let me tell you what that meant. He would, before holidays, every holiday, and for a while he did it Erev Rosh Chodesh, he would give a major talk on a topic related to the holiday. It was always at night, usually 8 o'clock, and the way that it went down was the following way. And Chaim will corroborate that I'm saying it exactly right. The Beis Medrash was jammed with people, many people from outside of Chaim Berlin, because they knew something great was going to be taking place. And there's a lot of chatter. And then you heard a clop, and then Rav Huttner walked in. Everybody stood up in awe, total silence. He would go to the front, he would sit down, and he would speak for an hour. People taking notes, people taping it. And it was always a masterpiece. When you finished, people were just silent because of the awesomeness of what they had just heard. Absolute genius, tapestries woven, a beginning, a middle, and an end that you thought never would ever come together, and it comes together in absolute genius. This is how he conveyed concepts and ideals of Jewish philosophy. That was his mode through the holidays, through Shabbos, through Rosh Chodesh, and every ikar, every fundamental formulation of Jewish ideas and thought were contained in these quote-unquote ma'amorim. They were delivered in Yiddish. And yet when they were transcribed in the most modern prose, Hebrew, where the language was so similar to Rav Kook. So similar to Rav Kook, just in the prose. And that is what these collections are. But in it, he took philosophy and psychology and Talmud and Agadah and Medrash, and he presented them in a way that just illuminated, opened up the topic to depths that you've never seen before. And these were great scholars, and each one of them. Each one of them were absolutely unassociated concepts that somehow come together. That was part of the genius, and that was his magnum opus. That's what people would, when he was in Israel, he had his yeshiva Pachad Yitzchak. It holds about 500 people in the Beis Medrash, and they have an Ezra's Nashim. It was absolutely jammed. You're too young. Did you ever go to Rabbi Yonatan David's? Right? Also. It's not the same as the Rosh Hashiva, but genius, absolute genius. And Moshe Shapiro, he had the same kind of a style. That's why these people, it's like, it's unbelievable. Just some of his philosophies that are very interesting. He believed, some of the themes, he believed clearly, this was a major theme for him in understanding politics, understanding the world as it affects the Jews. He believed in an equation. Esav equals Edom, which equals Romi, which equals Christianity, which equals Western civilization. So that whatever the Torah and Chazal say about Esav, that is how you analyze Western civilization. And he did it with great genius. His major essay, most controversial, probably the only thing that he ever did publicly. I believe the only thing he ever did publicly on a major topic was a talk that he gave in Torah Masorah about how to teach the Holocaust, which opened up a war, a basic war, in terms of how he saw the Holocaust. He saw the Holocaust not as a unique, isolated experience that the Jews suffered persecution, but he saw it as part of a prediction that was made in the Torah, as part of what was guaranteed in the Torah, as the tochecha of Parshas Kisavah. And he said it has to be taught that way. And if you teach it as something that's isolated, then you've done the 6 million a terrible injustice. I know that at that point, Lawrence Kaplan wrote a scathing attack against him, and many other people attacked him. But he didn't respond because he believed that he was 100% correct. That was, I believe, the only foray that he had into outside of the yeshiva walls. One of the other things that he had, which also is very much part of what is important today for him, is that every nation that exists today, unlike in biblical times, are all children of Avraham. There is no part of civilization today that we can identify except for the descendants of Avraham. The Christian world is Esav. That's a descendant of Avraham, Yitzchak's son. The Muslim world are descendants of Yishmael, Avraham's son. All of the Oriental and Asian nations are all B'nai Keturah, children of Avraham. So that all of them, based upon what we read about them in the Torah, all of them, that is how you analyze their descendants. So when he looked at the Arabs in Islam in a very early period, before it even happened, in Mamorim that he wrote in the 60s, what does it say about Yishmael? Al Pnei Kol Echav Nafal. And that was a prediction that they would try to take Israel away. Al Pnei Kol Echav Nafal. Whatever you have is what we have. And now we're seeing it even with Christianity. So Esav is also a part of the family. And that is what he said. And he said, and he also wrote, and so far it's true, that we will never, ever have a problem with China, with Japan, with any of the Asian nations, because they're B'nai Keturah, and it says in the Torah, Vayishalchem me'al Yitzchak b'no kedmo el eretz kedem, that Avram sent them far away from his son Yitzchak. Kedmo eretz kedem means far east, to the east of the east, far east. He said, we'll never have a problem with them. And to date, I wrote that in 1962. To date, we still haven't. If anything, during World War II, in Kobe, Japan, they helped the Jews. Shanghai, they helped the Jews. So this was part of his Belshazzar. But finally, I believe that the most central part of his being was Eretz Israel, was Israel. Israel for him, just like Rav Kook, Israel for him was the be-all and end-all of everything. In the 1960s, he began to travel to Israel extensively. Now, we also know that in 1967, right after the war, he bought a very large tract of land. Rav Scheinberg also bought a large tract of land next to him. At that time, it was called Kiryat Itri. Today, it's called Unsdorf. But he bought it was dirt cheap. He came from a real estate family. His wife was a real estate family, so he knew real estate. And he bought very, very large tracts of land there. For almost nothing, the government was basically giving it away so that you put up some apartments. They put up some apartments there, and he sold them. But ultimately, he didn't like that area because it was too frum. he just didn't like those kind of people. They were too fafunt. I don't know how to explain this to you. They were just too fafunt. He said, Zer Grisi. He just didn't live there. So he finally bought a large tract of land on Har Nof, where he built his yeshiva, where it is until this very, very day. Just one more word about, and you could read much of this in a book called Black September. But he was involved in a hijacking. And that was the hijacking of TWA in September 6, 1970. Now, what happened at that point was there were two planes. There was a Swiss plane that was hijacked. This was a plane that was hijacked over Belgium on its way to America. It was hijacked and it was brought to Amman and it was brought by the PLFP, which was a rival of Arafat at that time, and they immediately released the passengers who were not Jews and anybody who they suspected of being Jewish or they saw were Jewish. They held them for 3 weeks under terrible conditions. They were beaten. They were tortured. I know my friend Yankel Drumman was one of the people that was there. Rafutin never spoke about the experience ever. When he came back on that Rosh Hashanah, on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, he gave a ma'amar of Tehillat Hashem, but he never mentioned the experience. But I know from Rabbi Drumman, who's a Rosh Hashiva now in Brooklyn, that they were beaten and they were tortured. But the worst part was, he had suitcases of manuscripts that were bringing back to America to print. He was already an older person. He wasn't going to be able to rewrite a lot of it, but not all of it. And they destroyed it. That was for him the worst tragedy. The beatings, cutting his beard, starvation. I mean, he lost 50 pounds. I remember seeing him on Som Gedalia. He looked like half the person that he was a big man. Looked like half the person that he was. And just one more thing. I didn't even write it down. I don't know why I didn't write it down. I didn't remember it. He was the beginning of the Baal Tshuva movement. You would not know this. But because of his love of America and his love of Jews and his eclectic interests, he believed that there was no Jew who could not be turned on to Torah if given the proper incentive. And therefore, he encouraged his students. Or Sameach was started by his student, who he said, try it in Israel. Rabbi Shlomo Freifeld was one of his best students. He said, go to Farake, see what you can do. Open up Shor Yosef. The head of the NCSY, another one of his students, Rabbi Stolper, another one of his students. All of these people were all sent by Rav Hurta because he believed that the future of the Jewish people is in the Torah and that all Jewish people can be brought back. And that's not something that people often associate with Rav Hutner, but they should. But no other yeshiva did it, no other Rosh Yeshiva did it, but he did it. And to this day, those institutions are very, very successful in doing exactly the same thing. Okay, so there's much more to say. Tam v'lo nishlam, but at least I hope I gave some appreciation for the personality of this very, very great towering giant.
That was phenomenal. Can I ask, can you extend the series to talk about other rabbis like...